This is Jeff Spittler, February 27, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 15, King or Queen? Okay, well, I have to start off by way of apology here. I probably do have enough material to fill the whole time. I'm a bit behind on my preparation thanks to, a Suburban that got us stuck on the side of I-35 in Oklahoma City on Friday night. And then we had this windstorm. I had to cut up a tree and replace the skylights on the shed yesterday. And anyways, I'm running just a bit behind. But okay, so this is lesson 15. It means that this notebook is, the notes are just about full, so, and I've run out of page dividers, so I have to start another one. We're going to tentatively entitled this King or Queen? We left off last week with Moray, the Earl of Moray, having been assassinated by one of the Hamilton clan. And as we'll see shortly, this led to a great deal of instability and indeed civil war in Scotland for a period of 3 years. And it was divided, the civil war was along the lines of the people who, or men who called themselves the King's Party and the Queen's Party. But before we go into that, I thought we might reflect a little bit on the life of Moray. Maurice Lee, who's Moray's biographer, as far as I know his only biographer, quoted the historian P. Hume Brown, and is saying, of the two men, referring to Moray and Knox, it was Moray who indubitably did the most to ensure the success of the Scottish Reformation. And Lee concurs with that opinion. And my point in this isn't to say whether Knox did more or Moray did more, but rather just to kind of reflect on what Moray did. And I'd like to quote a little bit, a couple paragraphs from the sort of conclusion to Lee's book on Moray. So I think there's a couple interesting things that come out of this. If I can find the right spot here. I wrote the page numbers down wrong, so no wonder I couldn't find it. Okay. So he, this is after he's mentioned this quote by Hume Brown. He says, when Knox appeared on the scene in 1555, there are two questions to be answered. What form would the revolution take and would it succeed? Knox definitively answered the first. Thanks to him, the Scottish Reformation became distinctively Calvinistic. He also helped to answer the second by supplying the new movement with the type of leadership without which it could not succeed. This leadership was, emphasis here, not his own, but that of the feudal nobles whom he converted, for in Scotland only the nobility can ensure the success of a movement of any sort. Knox was fortunate in that he found the right man among his converts. The Protestant cause in Scotland has elsewhere attracted two sorts of men, those who joined out of religious zeal and those who joined for worldly motives of one sort or another. The problem was to keep the two groups working together. This was Moray's great contribution to Scottish Protestantism. He was a man of great piety and a blameless personal life, who because of his austere morality could retain the loyalty and respect of the Protestant zealots. At the same time, he was a skillful soldier, politician, and administrator who could keep the materialistically inclined nobility in hand by moderation and concessions and extreme caution. In this respect, Moray was unique, as the difficulties of the years 1570 to 1573 show. There were some who were as pious as he, Glencairn and Lindsay, for instance, but they had no political ability. There were but a few with his political skill, Maitland, Morton, perhaps Archbishop Hamilton. None of these could command the respect of earnest Protestants, much less that of Knox. Morey was indispensable as a party leader. Under his skillful guidance, the Protestants, after overturning the old religion in 1559 to 1560, weathered the fearful threat represented by Mary. He died a few years too soon, for he might have spared Scotland the Civil War of the 1570s. Even so, by the time of his death, his work was so well done that his party could continue to function with non-entities, and then a corrupt tyrant at its head. It was Morey, then, who was chiefly responsible for the triumph of the Reformation in Scotland, for without him it is difficult to see how the new religion could have survived the challenge of Mary. In this way, Morey has left his mark on the face of Scotland to this day. Okay, so, again, you know, my point isn't to say, oh, Morey was, you know, more important than Knox or whatever. I think in God's providence, you know, he uses all sorts of men to do his will. And, you know, I just think it's kind of interesting reflection on a, you know, from his biographer on the sort of things that he contributed in terms of making the Reformation, or maybe you should say establishing the Reformation in Scotland. He was also able to maintain good relations with England. Okay, and yes.
The biographer indicated that he had Knox's respect. Is that really true, or, I mean, as far as you can tell?
Yes. As we mentioned, at one time Knox and Morey were estranged, and basically because Morey was making the kind of political concessions that, you know, not some of which Knox did not approve of the things that he was some of the things Morey was doing. But basically, after the Chaseabout raids, he left, you know, was exiled, and when he came back to Scotland, he and Knox were reconciled. And I think, yeah, I think he did have Knox's respect. Okay, the trick question now. Okay.
No, not a trick question, but I mean, Morey was friendly. He was a politician. He built coalition amongst people who tried to hold things according to Lee. According, he tried to build coalitions between people who you know could be going sort of in the same direction on a superficial level, but didn't necessarily agree on doctrinal things. And presumably that was what Knox found so distasteful, and what caused him to be estranged to him in the first place. The fact that he was a compromiser. Is that a fair statement or not?
I think he compromised where Knox would not have compromised. I mean, to some degree, Knox, of course, was also a politician, not in the same sense that Morey was. Knox was also a pragmatist to some degree. I don't mean he was just, you know, compromised anywhere he deemed expedient, but I mean, Knox also worked with a coalition of men, some of whom were, you know, almost certainly not regenerate, and probably obviously so.
I wonder if Knox saw his latest ministry.
Okay.
Is his tone changing?
Well, Knox is, I think his most, this may not be his most recent biographer, but this is probably the most recent sort of scholarly biography by Jasper Ridley, and we're, if you read it, you'll find that in many respects he just disdains Knox, but he thinks Knox became more cynical over the years. So he constantly points this out when Knox at one point reprimanded Protestant lords for doing certain things early on, and then later on he didn't say anything when they, you know, would do certain things. It's said, this is right before Knox died, that the Earl of Morton went to visit him, and nobody knew what they talked about until Morton was being executed. He said that Knox had asked him whether or not he had anything to do with the death of with the murder of Darnley. Mm-hmm. And so Knox's biographer Ridley says that, you know, this shows how cynical he was, is that even though at the same time he was saying that Mary should be executed and so on for her, her part in Darnley's murder, that he sort of harbored thoughts that one of the people that he worked with, this Morton, might have also been been implicated. So, in any, I guess my point is that certainly some of Knox's biographers think he changed. I think, you know, and he became maybe more of a pragmatist and more cynical over the years. That you know, there may be some truth to that. I don't. Yeah, certainly also, of course, I think as Knox got older and he was somewhat ill, probably the sort of things he could expend energy on, or the sort of scope that he could expend energy on, was probably reduced. So, but, you know, Knox, again, he did preach more at his funeral sermon. Apparently it was a, you know, I mean, I think they were, I think they respected each other at the end. That's, so even though they had their differences, and Morey was also able to maintain good relations with England, right? Even though Elizabeth was often indecisive, she was inconsistent, she vacillated on issues related to Scotland. She had certain sort of internal conflicts, which you know, one was the sort of the divine right of kings, which would suggest that Mary, you know, nobody should touch Mary Stuart. And then on the other hand, pragmatic political considerations, and that the party that was basically overthrowing Mary Stuart was Protestant and was amiable towards England, whereas Mary Stuart was still claiming she was rightfully Queen of England. Rightfully, she should be the Queen of England. So, Lee also points out at the end, again, this is partly speculative since we don't know what would have happened, but that if England had faced a hostile northern neighbor ruled by a Catholic queen, one who viewed herself and was viewed by English Catholics as the rightful ruler of England, you know, the person who should be sitting on the throne, that the outcome of the Reformation on the continent might have been considerably different, because Elizabeth aided some of the Protestants in the Netherlands and some other places on the continent. And if I can find this, the elimination of the possibility of a return to Catholicism in England, except through a foreign invasion, in its turn had profound effects on Europe as a whole. England was the only really powerful Protestant state in Europe and was looked on by Protestants everywhere as their natural ally in the struggle against the aggressive Catholicism of the Counter-Reformation. Elizabeth supported the Protestants of France and of the Netherlands, not because they were Protestants, but because it was politically expedient to do so. She was aware that her chances for survival depended on her ability to prevent a Franco-Spanish combination against her. The easiest way to do this was to keep France and Spain occupied at home by seeing to it that their rebellious Protestant subjects were not crushed. To what extent the French and Dutch Calvinists owed their ultimate successes to Elizabeth is debatable. Without her aid, they might well have gone under, and if England had been Catholic, they certainly would have. It is most improbable that Elizabeth would have helped them had she had a hostile Catholic Scotland at her back. So it can be said with a good deal of justification that Morey contributed substantially to the survival of Protestantism in Europe by ensuring its triumph in Great Britain. That of course is, you know, it's somewhat speculative account, but I think you can see how if we give God all the glory that he deserves, that, you know, in his providence, his complex working of effects, working out working out of his will in history, but in a fairly complex manner, benefited not only the Reformation in Scotland and in England, but also in the continent of Europe, and also later the United States. So, anyways, thought that was kind of interesting. So, okay. After Morey died, it led. There were sort of 3 years of a civil war of sorts. It might not be the sort of full-scale civil war that we might imagine from our own civil war here in the U.S. But and this was not, as it might be imagined, to avenge his death, but rather it just left a vacuum in leadership. And because of that, some existing conflicts and tensions that in his lifetime he was able, through his combination of political acumen and also his soldiery, was able to sort of keep repressed. These things, they erupted into the level of war after Morey died. So if you recall, Mary is still in England at this point, somewhat in limbo. She hadn't been judged guilty of the murder of Darnley, but she was still imprisoned. In a nice prison, but still imprisoned. And basically, this allowed the two sides in the Civil War to... They were sort of allied themselves, depending on who they supported, and they would call themselves either the King's Party or the Queen's Party. The King's Party, more or less, represented the continuation of Moray's policies. They were really led by the lords of the congregation, the Protestant lords. The Queen's Party was, of course, made up of supporters of Mary, who hoped to return her to the throne. Now, they weren't necessarily all Catholics, and there was a fair amount of Scotland inter-family feuding. I was thinking about this. I suppose the word feud must come from feudal, right? And in Scotland, these feudal families, some of them really hated each other, and in any case, some of the battles, or some of the fighting, was certainly motivated by that. Let's see. The Queen's Party held Edinburgh Castle, and Edinburgh, more or less, they held Dumbarton Castle. They could count 9 earls and 13 lords among their members. And Maitland of Lethington, right, who had been the Queen's Secretary of State, he joined the Queen's Party. And in July of 1570, the Earl of Lennox, Darnley's father, was appointed regent by the King's Party. That further exacerbated the feud between the King's Party and the Hamiltons. Right, the Hamiltons had historically been the, you know, had held the regency. Right, the Earl of Arran was a Hamilton, and the Hamiltons, of course, had murdered Moray, and so. John Knox was preaching that the Hamiltons are murderers, so it exacerbated this feud. There were a number of battles, and let's see, in April 1571, Dumbarton Castle was taken by the King's Party. Let's see, Archbishop Hamilton was in it. He was a conspirator in the Moray murder, so they hanged him. The Queen's Party started to waver. Some of the lords came over to the King's Party in the summer of 1571. At the same time, really two things happened that I think politically weakened the Queen's Party. One was this what was called the Ridolfi Plot. Mary was involved in a number of plots over time, and finally she was executed because of that. But there was an Italian banker, and there was a plot with an English lord, Lord Norfolk, they were going to get Spanish troops from the Netherlands under General Alva, who was Philip's general in the Netherlands. They were supposed to invade Scotland. In fact, they were going to come in at Edinburgh, so having the castle there would be very handy. And this plot was exposed. They'd sent over 600 pounds in gold. Not 600 pounds by weight, I'm sure, but 600 pounds of gold. And they caught a courier with this gold, and they basically they went back to Mary's secretary, or I'm sorry, Norfolk's secretary, and they used ingenious methods for getting information out of him. And they found all this letters written in code, and where the key to the code was, and all this stuff that exposed this whole plot. So that, of course, wasn't good for the Queen's Party politically, because some of them still were, they were basically posturing themselves, like Maitland was still posturing themselves, as if what they wanted was Elizabeth to restore Mary to the throne of Scotland. And but of course, the Ridolfi plot showed that Mary was trying to get herself on the throne of England. So there's also supposed to be an uprising of English Catholics to go along with this. So, that plotting, of course, certainly weakened the Queen's Party when it was exposed. Also, George Buchanan in 1571 published his book, which is entitled, this is a translation from Latin, The detection of the doings of Mary, Queen of Scots, touching the murder of her husband and her conspiracy, adultery, and pretended marriage with the Earl of Bothwell. Okay, it was written in Latin, but it had a scholarly attention to detail and a poet's gift for vivid phrases. It created a sensation that was cumulatively horrifying. And that, of course, further weakened the king's party, or the queen's party. And Otto Scott comments on this, and I think the thing that I want to get at comes in this section here about this writing of the book. In fact, the basic point is that the book, I mean, on one hand, it exposed the queen, right? But on the other hand, it was also implicitly an attack on the divine right of kings. Here's a subject writing about, you know, all the crimes that the sovereign's guilty of. And this is Otto Scott. He says, yet the great poet, okay, and Buchanan was a poet and a playwright and a man of letters. He says, yet the great poet's effort had a deeper significance than many of its critics and even its supporters did not at the time clearly understand. John Knox was famous through his own writings and books, but Knox was a theologian and a religious leader. His fame did not approach for a century or longer that of George Buchanan, who was a great literary idol of Europe. Until Buchanan became disillusioned with Mary Stuart, whose courtier he had been, he had always remained a man of high letters. His great fame rested on poems and plays whose political implications were shrouded in oblique references and mass personae, and appeared in hints and gleams or in satire, and no more. By fashioning the case against Mary Stuart in the beautifully balanced Latin cadences that had made him famous, Buchanan carried Knox's arguments against the sacred prerogatives of sovereigns from the churches and castles of remote Scotland and England into the teeming centers of European thought. His Detectio did not so much state that case as rest upon it. That inner meaning sank more easily into the minds of readers by being implicit. By arguing about the guilt or innocence of Mary Stuart, he led his readers, believers and critics alike, unconsciously to accept the idea that great sovereigns can be judged, like their subjects, on the rules of evidence and the law. His book, therefore, was a great weapon for Knox's revolution and its doctrines. So, again, you know, the point is just that the book itself, by appearing, was in itself revolutionary. Mike.
And divine right is sovereign. When did that appear? Was the backdrop of that divine right is sovereign, was it Christian based, or how did it come to pass? And what essentially was it? Obviously, it comes about spiritual.
Yeah, the divine right. I cannot tell you the whole history of it, but I mean, from obviously, it's always been the desire of kings to be above the law, right, and to have their orders and decrees accepted as if they came from God himself. So, I mean, you could look back even to like the Roman Caesars in a pre-Christian era as wanting to say that they were God.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, I mean, it's a standard human temptation of kings. I'm sorry, Vicki, did you want to?
It also implied that in the divine right of kings, because they have been divinely appointed.
Right. So, the Christian, I think I would say this is more of a doctrine that's sort of baptized with some Christian thought, right? And so there is this, you know, in the Paul speaks about the civil magistrate being appointed for, you know, the subject's good and so on. He's a minister to do good. And so on. And so they took that and then tried to absolutize it, right? And say that, you know, that obviously the sovereign's appointed by God, right? And therefore the sovereign has this divine right. Okay, you had like a three-part question. I'm not sure if I've got two parts or... Okay.
Is there a book that we're talking about here, or is it just an idea? I'm a little confused.
On the divine right of kings.
I guess I didn't follow it.
Okay, there was a book, right, that was written by George Buchanan called this
right.
Detection of the Doings.
I'm asking if there's a book on the divine right of kings.
I'm sure there probably was, but no, not we're not talking about a book on it. Right. We're just talking about the fact that the book, this book, The Detection of, you know, on Mary, implicitly had this idea that sovereigns were not above the law, and it was basically a shot across the bow, if you will, at the doctrine of the divine right of kings. And later there would be books, of course, that in Scotland that would sort of maintain that, but at this point, I guess it was implicit that the sovereigns were not above the law. So
it was generally the Catholics that were defending the divine right of kings, right? Generally?
I would say generally that's true, yes. And probably it's more, what is more natural in sort of Catholic circles, because the Pope would somehow, you know, put his blessing on the sovereign. But what you'll find is James the Sixth, who claims to be a Protestant, will also defend the divine right of kings. So.
Well, and he also resorted to Arminianism and anti-Protestant doctrines to theologically back up that position and to make his appointments in the church.
Right. Yeah. No. His claim to be a Protestant is, very tenuous, and we'll see that. I'm sure it'll only take us, about 15 lessons to get through his reign. So.
But one thing that Father Scott pointed out was that early feudalism led to some advancements in Christianity, and I just want to point to one thing: the right to trial by a jury of your peers. It wasn't like we have today, but it was at least the lords were considered equal and able to try another lord.
Okay.
Yeah. But then as the Renaissance happened, those things lost some power.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay. That's good. That's a good point. It's not... It's not just a case of exact progression in history where we're finally seeing this idea weaken, but in fact, the idea had not always been as strong as it was, after the Renaissance. So, but we're about to see this idea basically destroyed. But of course, even today, it's obviously a temptation, right? If we look at our commander-in-chief, he'd like to be above the law, wouldn't he? And apparently is above the law of our House of Representatives, is any indication. So, okay, let's see. I'm purposely not trying to recount all the battles of the Civil War and so on, but in September 1571, soldiers led by one of the Hamiltons attempted to capture a number of lords of the king's party. They were meeting. There was a parliament held in Stirling, and they actually had captured a number of them. And then some of the other troops arrived on the scene, and the troops under Hamilton started to flee. But he ordered that the Earl of Lennox be killed before they fled. So somebody just, I guess shot him with a hagebutt or harquebus. And he died, and James the Sixth later claimed that was his first conscious memory, was seeing the bleeding body of his grandfather being carried into the castle. John Erskine, the Earl of Mar, was appointed regent in his place. And while Scotland was in political turmoil, the church was also having problems of its own, due, I would say, still to some of the artifacts of the Catholic establishment. Okay, you'll recall we had these fairly long discussions on the holders of the benefices, right, and all the problems that entailed when they had archbishops and so on that had, clerical concubines and, ran their own little fiefdoms. Well, the benefices and this arrangement was still present. And, for instance, Archbishop Hamilton that we just mentioned, he was, an appointed archbishop. So at this point, some of the nobility, the Protestant lords, were conniving to obtain the benefices, right? And the benefices would be income from property rental and also from tithes. The basic scheme that they were trying to do was they would appoint someone in their place who would agree to give most of the money to them. So it's like, you know, we could offer somebody, you could be the Archbishop of whatever, of Payne County, and, you know, it pays £1,000 per year, but you have to give me 950 or something. And this was also further complicated by the fact that the Archbishop would also have a seat in Parliament. They didn't have parliamentary elections in the way that we would think, but they the different estates of Scotland, the nobility and the church, were represented in Parliament. And in August of 1571, the Earl of Morton, who will be the next regent after the Earl of Mar dies, attempted to seat a replacement for Archbishop Hamilton in Parliament. And the church objected to this, since the church hadn't examined the nominee. And but that's just the tip of the iceberg. And both from the perspective of the question at hand, you know, what if we're going to have archbishops, how would they be appointed? How would they work? Because they don't fit in with the Book of Discipline. And historically, right, this is just the start, and this is going to become this issue of whether or not the civil magistrate, the nobility, or the king can appoint bishops will become a real bone of contention. And in the future, but just sort of starting here, the church has been established legally, and they're now, we're starting to have some of these archbishops die, one because he was hanged, the Earl of Morton tries to put one in place. And so the regent, the Earl of Mar, appointed a committee to examine the issue. It was made up of some ministers and some nobles, but it was pretty much weighted with those who were in favor of maintaining this system of appointed archbishops, and with their benefices going back to the nobility. They reached sort of a compromise solution. They met at Leith, which is the port, well, near Edinburgh now, I guess, in Edinburgh. Let's see if I can. Okay, this is from James Hewison King, his History of the Covenanters. The first provision, the one that's of interest in this concordat, is that archbishops and bishops have charge of the former diocese, be chosen from qualified preachers, not less than 30 years of age, and endowed with the qualities specified in the epistles of Paul to Timothy and Titus. Exercise the functions of superintendents meantime, be subject to the assembly in spiritual matters, to the king and temporal, be consecrated, be elected and assisted by a chapter of pastors, and resume their benefices and their seats in Parliament. And so that's basically an attempt at a compromise between the two schemes. In this scheme, then, there could be archbishops, but they would be they would be qualified as preachers, tested, have the qualifications of elders that Paul spelled out, and they would exercise the function of superintendents. Okay, but also in a section of the manner of creating a bishop, it provides, we, which in other words the crown, have thought good to name or recommend him to you to be chosen to the said bishopric. In other words, the king would sort of suggest who was be appointed to be bishop. And the bishop's oath is included, I confess to have and hold the said bishopric and possessions of the same under God, only of your majesty and crown royal. And for the said possessions I do my homage present to your majesty. Okay, so in other words, this is a form of fealty where the bishop became the king's man, and of course, under the scheme, then the clergy would become the bishop's men. The oath also included, your majesty is the only lawful and supreme governor of this realm, as well in things temporal, as in the conservation and purgation of the religion. Okay, so this was what the committee's solution was. It was adopted by the assembly. It was adopted as an interim measure. John Erskine, the Earl of Mar's cousin, was the moderator. He'd earlier written his cousin, Bishops, as such, have no office and jurisdiction, for they enter not by the door, but by another way, and therefore are not pastors, as saith Christ, but thieves and robbers. But they received it basically, in their own words, that the said heads and articles agreed upon be only received as an interim, until farther and more perfect order be obtained at the hands of the king's majesty's regent and nobility. So they accepted it as an interim measure. Knox himself wrote a letter which a little bit of it touched on it, but these bishops were called, and I have to accept my pronunciation. It's T-U-L-C-H-A-M. I've been trying to decide if it's Tulchin. I guess that's probably how it should be pronounced. Or for some reason I want to pronounce the C-H-S-K, so it would be Tulchin. But Tulchin bishops. Okay, and as explained by Calderwood, 17th century historian, a Tulchin is a calf's skin stuffed with straw to cause the cow to give milk. For the lords got the benefices and presented such a man as would be content with the least commodity and set the rest in fused tax pensions to them or theirs. In other words, the farmer would put this stuffed calf in front of the cow and the cow would give the milk. The lord would present this bishop in front of the church and the church, or, and what was rightfully of the churches would then go to the bishop. So.
Did Knox get around to straightening that whole mess out? Basically, it was just a wrong view of the time, right? I mean, they didn't have this concept of people supporting their pastor.
Well, there were ties. Yeah, it was a view inherited, and no, Knox did not get around to straightening it out. We're now in the last year of Knox's life, so.
It seems like that this is going to be a fatal chink in the whole system. All this money coming in,
right.
And so there's always a power grab going on.
It is a fatal chink in the whole system. That's right. So. Knox, as I mentioned, he's in very feeble health at this point. He was in St. Andrews at the time because the Queen's party was holding Edinburgh, and he sent what you might call a last blast of the trumpet. It's not what he called it, but he sent this letter. See, my printer started to give out, so, well, here we go. I guess I can probably read it from the... in the original sort of Scottish. I'm not sure which is rougher, of having a few English words missing or trying to read in Scottish, but albeit I have taken my leave not only of you, dear brethren, but also of the whole world and all worldly affairs. And this letter is being written to the assembly that's meeting in Perth 5th of August, 1572 is when the letter is written. Yeah, they're meeting at the 6th. And this letter was hand-carried. Yet remaining in the flesh, I could not nor cannot cease to admonish you of things which I know to be most prejudicial to the kirk of Christ Jesus within this realm. Above all things, preserve the kirk from the bondage of the universities. Persuade them to rule themselves peaceably and order their schools in Christ, but subject never the pulpit to their judgment, neither yet exempt them from your jurisdiction. I thought Rob would like this, but... Take heed that nothing proceed under your name be particular factions. Farther, I have communicated my mind with the two dear brethren. Hear them, and do as you will answer before God, who presently worketh potently, how blind that ever the world remaineth. Fight ye in the truth, and for the liberty of the same, and be assured to triumph of Jesus Christ, to whose mighty protection I unfeignedly commit you. Okay, written from St. Andrews, the 5th day of August, 1572. And then included in this were some articles where he did basically address the bishops, but he addressed it only in sort of a sideways manner. He said that no gift of any bishopric or other benefice be given to any person contrary to the tenor of the acts made in the time of the first regent of good memory, And they that are given contrary to said acts or to any unqualified persons may be revoked and declared null by an act of secret council. And that all bishoprics vacant may be presented and qualified persons nominated thereunto within a year after the vacating thereof, according to the order taken in Leith by the commissioners of the nobility and of the Kirk in the month of January last. And in special, to complain about upon the giving of the bishopric of Ross to Lord Methven. So these are articles which I believe were intended for the assembly's consideration. That no pensions of benefices, great or small, be given by simple donation of my Lord Regent without consent of the possessor of the said benefices, having title thereto in the admission of the superintendent or commissioner of the province where this benefice lieth, or of the bishops lawfully elected according to the said order taken at Leith, and desire an act of council to be made thereupon unto the next parliament, wherein the same be specially enacted, with inhibition to the Lords of Session to give any letter or decrees upon such simple gifts of benefits or pensions, not being given in manner above rehearsed, and that the Kirk presently assembled declare all such gifts null so far as lieth in their power. That if that the first form of presentation to benefices, which were in the first and second regent's time, be not changed as now it is commonly, but that this clause be contained in the presentations, that if the persons presented make not residence, or be slanderous, or found unworthy in either in life or doctrine by the judgment of the Kirk, to the which always he shall be subject, to which always he shall be subject, or meet to be transported to another room at the side of the Kirk, that the said presentation, and all that shall fall thereupon, shall be null and of no force nor effect. And this day have place also in the nomination of bishops. Nonetheless, another article requires that the bishops basically be audited every year to give an account of their rents and patrimonies. So, this comes up because there's some Episcopalian partisans say that Knox approved of bishops, and he supported episcopacy because he dealt with this. And did Knox support episcopacy? And the answer, I think, is no. Knox's biographers are basically all that I can find are all agreed on this point. Ridley, again, a secular biography of Knox, it says there's no doubt as to where Knox's sympathies lay in 1571 and 1572, but he did not put up a serious fight against them, the bishops, either before or after the agreement of Leith. His political realism made him reluctant to split the unity of the king's side. He did not attempt to fight the corruption of Morton, as he had fought, at least to some extent, the corruption of Northumberland, the Protestant lords in England. He was now much older, much more tired and ill, and much more cynical than he had been 20 years before. His only interest was to crush the Queen's men, and especially Grange and the Castilians in Edinburgh. And these were the men holding the castle in Edinburgh, the one that was making them vulnerable to this plot to land Spanish troops in Scotland. And in any case, they... I don't know if it's that important an issue, but there is some question about whether or not, why didn't Knox... right against this. And Ridley at least gives, says basically he's old, tired, and there's a potentially very factious situation which he didn't want to open a split in.
You did say that earlier, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't know what he's ill of. He's just very ill. Nobody really says. He was... Okay, there's this debate about how old he was. I said he was born in 1505. I guess later scholarship suggests that it was probably 1515 that he was born in due to some confusion about how old he was. But in any case, if he was born in 1515, he was now 56, 57, something like that. So he was, for 16th century, he was pretty old. Mike?
Why, if he was old people... Why does he take and put energy in this idea about the universities don't take care of the church of the universities? It seems to me that why would he consider that a distraction?
Well, I think for the reason that we've discussed before, that that universities can have an... there's possible for them, if they're allowed to have sort of control over who's in the ministry, they can certainly have an adverse effect on Christianity. I think if you're asking why specifically did he write that at this point, that's a good question. I don't really know if there was an issue at hand.
Well, Westerly claims that the universities were self-consciously ecclesiastical, that they were claiming ecclesiastical authority, self-consciously, the whole.
Okay.
I
can give you an off-the-cuff reason that's probably right now that I think about it. He had just come from living at St. Andrews, just come from the university, and at the university, the college that he was preached at and so on was very sympathetic to the King's Party, but he'd actually been involved in some disputes where certain people in the church wanted to stay neutral and some supported the Queen's Party and various things. So that may be why at this time he'd just come from the university, and perhaps that's is on his mind, yeah. Well, in fact, he actually wrote this. He hadn't actually left Edinburgh yet, or he hadn't left St. Andrews yet for Edinburgh. So, I'll tell you what, we're just about, let me just sort of sum up what's going to happen. We might come back to it next week. There was a truce at the end of July 1572 between the King's Party and the Queen's Party. On that basis, Knox returned to Edinburgh, where he was actually...